President Eisenhower gave some 29 Republican and Democratic congressional leaders a briefing today on the new $3.5 billion foreign aid program, which he's asking for the coming fiscal year. And he told them that he feels a deep personal concern over the importance of the program as a means of helping to ease world tensions and to make some progress toward permanent world peace. The conference was not confined to the foreign aid program, but included a fill-in by Secretary of State Dulles on the world picture generally, including Formosa. But the consensus among those present was that there was nothing either new or exciting in the information they received, except that the prospects of peace seemed to be improving slightly. Several of those who were present told me that they based that idea on the improved situation in Indochina in the last 48 hours, with the loyalist Vietnam troops under Premier Diem now in the process of mopping up the last of the rebel forces in the city of Saigon. They informed me that, in spite of the fact that Admiral Radford, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is just back from Formosa and had the highly secret conferences there with Chiang Kai-shek, had just finished reporting to the president when the conference began, there was no light shed on the Red China Nationalist China picture beyond what already was known. The president's chief purpose in the sessions today, apparently, was to plug for his foreign aid program, and the general reaction among those who attended was friendly, although they emphasized that no new commitments were asked for or given by them, leaving the clear impression that most of them favor a foreign aid program of some degree, but they're not prepared to go as far as the president wants. About $1.5 billion of the program, according to Mr. Eisenhower's estimates, should go to the Far East. Some of that unquestionably will be approved. There's an item of $460 million for South Korea, which probably is all right, and an item of $425 for Indochina, which also probably is all right, particularly if, or provided, let's say, Diem is able to hold on to the government there. But there are a couple of other items that seem very definitely and drastically out of line, one in one direction and the other in the other. For example, the amount allocated for Nationalist China is $102 million, which compared with the two figures I just mentioned, seems definitely on the short side, the very short side, considering what is needed there. But then, if you please, there is another item of almost as much, $85 million, and that goes to India, of all places, the India of Prime Minister Nehru, who has just gotten through a full and lusty week of trying to slit our throats at the Bandung conference in favor of Red China. This is the sort of thing that shakes you, you know, with the people in control here in Washington at the present time. Here is a government, Nehru's government, that has an unbroken and systematic record of insulting us, teaming against us at every possible turn in favor of communist Russia and communist China, conspiring against us in so-called neutral commissions of one kind or another, giving aid and comfort to the communists at every turn, supporting the Red Chinese in the contention that we should sell out Chiang Kai-shek to the Reds, and we propose to give them $85 million just out of the goodness of our hearts and the generosity of our pocketbooks. Are you able to understand just why we should give anything to India? Has India done anything to justify any friendship or gratitude or appreciation on our part? And to make it the more ridiculous, the program provides for Pakistan, which has been our staunchest and most faithful ally in Southern Asia, and which wants aid not for economic purposes, but for military weapons to help fight communism. Only $92 million, or $7 million more than India. Once again, a reflection of past Truman-Acheson atmosphere under which we put up with anything except any insults that anybody wants to hurl at us, reward them with abundance, and don't give our loyal friends even enough out of our surplus mothball equipment to ensure their security in defending themselves. It's a disheartening business, believe me, and you wonder who in the world can be behind it. Last night I mentioned the tenor of my mail that's been coming in, flooding in from all over the country. Let me read you just a few short excerpts. First, from Detroit, Michigan. Quote, "How does the Eisenhower administration differ from that of Truman's? Isn't our policy still being set by a number 10 Downing Street as usual? Aren't our soldiers still being used as pawns all over the world, being seen in prison camps all over Russia and China? and this from San Jose, California. I have 3 sons in the service. I know what war may mean. I also know of what little help my government will give to them if they fall into the enemy's hands, which God forbid. But if we are to preserve America and our constitutional liberties, if we are to recover the stature of our forefathers, we must be ever ready to, and willing to fight, if necessary, regardless of the consequences. Appeasement is weakness, and weakness invites continued aggression, which ends in disaster. And this one from Phoenix, Arizona. I'm in the life insurance business. My wife is a teacher. We have 2 sons. The eldest, now aged 22, served in Korea and was on the front. He came back with haunting memories of American boys who gave their lives to fight this thing we now would, by the rumors of a few leftists, give in to once again. The other son, now 21, is in Europe serving his country. The great majority of U.S. citizens who fall into our category can be aroused to reject any such move. I served in France in World War I, and for these 38 years since, we have given hundreds of thousands of lives, hundreds of billions of dollars, and great blocks of the earth, along with bottling up about half the population of the world within communist curtains to try to appease this monster. Still, a few would have us continue to feed the monster. Now, those are just samples, but that is the tenor of all of them. Hundreds, even thousands, from every corner of the nation, just a voluntary outpouring of the feelings of ordinary citizens, ordinary Americans, and yet the people who make policy for the administration, whoever they are taken in by the prattle, the hogwash, that the reason the Eisenhower administration was elected in 1952 was because it promised to end the war in Korea. The truth is, the Korean War situation entered into the voting of 1952 only on the basis that the Eisenhower administration promised to end the disgrace of Korea as it had been conducted by the Truman-Acheson administration, and to regain America's self-respect and honor, and to stop appeasing the Chinese communists. That was the story of 1952, not that the American people wanted peace at any price. They don't, they never have, they never will. They want principle and strength and self-respect, and they want no selling out of that principle. And regardless of what may be going on behind the scenes in government here, to the contrary, there is a firm impression being left over the country by the activities of government here, a firm impression in the minds of the people who make up the country that our government is allowing itself to be talked by insidious elements here at home and by appeaser governments abroad, being talked into allowing the Red Chinese to continue to nibble away at the Far East because we are afraid to take a stand. The people who write these letters don't like it, and I don't like it either. And I don't believe that any red-blooded American likes it either. If we don't stand up to the communists, who is going to? And if we don't support firmly and strongly those who do want to stand up to them and are willing to sacrifice their own blood in order to maintain their freedom and their honor, why are we pouring billions upon billions of dollars out all over the world in the pretense of fighting communism? With one side of our mouths, we talk against it. With the other side, we appease it. And with our hands, we give millions in gifts to our enemies. That may make some sense to somebody. It makes no sense at all to me, and I'm frank to say so. Here at home, the House and Senate reached a tentative agreement on the postal pay increase bill with a schedule of increases that averages 8.8%, as against 7.6%, which was the most the administration said it was willing to go, and against 10%, which is a figure voted by the Senate. It probably will get a veto from the president because it's been warned from the very outset that Mr. Eisenhower will not go any higher than the 7.6% figure, and if it is vetoed, there's virtually no chance that it can be passed over the veto, and likewise virtually no chance that any new postal pay increase bill can be put through during this session of Congress. That means, of course, that the postal workers go for another year at least, and they will have only their... without a pay raise, and they'll have only their ill-advised lobbyists here in Washington who insisted upon their own terms or nothing to thank for the loss. A shame, you know, because your postman and the people in your local post office are great people. They serve you through rain, snow, heat, cold, fair weather, and foul, and they are underpaid. And you wonder sometimes whether these lobbyists, who for the second consecutive year now are wrecking the pay increase bill that could be, are really interested in the welfare of the postal workers they are supposed to represent, or whether they're more interested in politics and making sure that they continue to have something to lobby for and thus hold their jobs. new head of the economic aid side of the foreign aid program when it's transferred to the State Department, Mr. John Hollister, is at least one refreshing face in the picture. He happens to be the former law partner and very close friend and supporter of the late Robert A. Taft of Ohio, and a man with the same basic philosophy as Taft. He was at one time with UNRRA in the enviable position, I said enviable, of liquidating one of the UNRRA offices abroad in the Netherlands, and he more recently has been the executive director of the Governmental Reorganization Commission under former President Herbert Hoover. In fact, he's been the executive director of the commission, and if anybody can whip this foreign aid program into making some sense, certainly he ought to be able to do it. But coming into the show now, he had no say-so, of course, in deciding on those estimates which the president came up with today. The Department of Justice says the action against the American Newspaper Publishers Association and the American Association of Advertising Agencies on antitrust charges must go through because the activities of those accused have made it impossible for the government to get a peaceful settlement. That's the top of the news as it looks from here.